In what follows, I'm going to fully conform to the spirit in which the study day today has been organised, and I'm going to offer some very general and speculative reflections on the relations between meaning and context as they affect my own discipline, lexical semantics. And presumably, there's no need to convince anybody here of the centrality of questions of context to linguistics generally or to semantics specifically. But it seems to me that semantics could benefit from closer connection to the other parts of linguistics and indeed philosophy in which questions of context are studied. I think semanticists have something of a tendency to isolate themselves, with the result that the study of meaning risks becoming disconnected from research, which it should have a close connection to. And in order to overcome that sort of disciplinary balkanization, it's necessary and unavoidable that researchers will have to go beyond their strict disciplinary confines. And obviously that carries dangers. Nevertheless, in this talk, I haven't hesitated to draw on work from the last few decades in pragmatics, and also results from studies of semantic processing and cognition more generally, since it seems to me that a global perspective is particularly likely to bring some sort of insight into questions of the relation between meaning, cognition, and context. So there's a short summary of the talk that I'm going to give. And as you can see, I'm going to start by talking about the received view of the relationship between meaning and context, as most linguists and most semanticians, I think, still conceive of it. Okay, so if meaning is understood in its traditional sense, namely as those aspects of an expression which determine its referential and inferential properties, then it's obvious that context forms an inevitable part of semantics. Meaning is what determines use. It's what determines reference and inference. And that use occurs inevitably within some wider context. So it's a natural expectation that meaning-context interactions should fall at the centre of semantic reflection and not just at the centre of pragmatic reflection. Traditional linguistic reflection, though, has tended to minimise the importance of context in analyses of the relation between meaning and use. According to the conception of context that's traditional in linguistics, context, in most cases, only supplies information that's missing from the message itself. That's the first bullet point on the screen. And of course, there's a widespread and significant exception to this, and it's found in what's called contextualist or radical pragmatic theories, but I don't have any time to simply mention that as a significant exception to the generalisation that I'm otherwise drawing about the relation between meaning and context as it's viewed in linguistics. Okay, as a way then of sharpening our picture of the way that meaning and context are supposed to relate, let's consider the various factors that are involved in the transmission and understanding of a message, and let's do that by focusing on the hearer. Well, before the utterance happens, the hearer is, of course, in a certain initial or background information state. They're entertaining certain beliefs, assumptions, and so on. And to idealise and simplify scandalously, let's just treat all of those background assumptions, the background cognitive state generally of the hearer, let's treat that as a set of propositions that the hearer is entertaining or able to entertain. Then comes the utterance. And once the utterance has been articulated, understanding it first involves representing the full extent of the linguistically coded information that the utterance conveys. Secondly, it involves applying propositions in the background state to that linguistically coded information in order to derive the proposition that is communicated by the utterance in the case of a simple assertion. And I'll illustrate that in a moment, that process. But What I want to draw attention to is the fact that what we call context enters the picture as the source of the propositions in the background information state that the hearer finds themselves in. So to illustrate, imagine that I utter the phrase, "It's raining." You will derive from that the proposition, "It's raining outside now." And you'll do that by pragmatically enriching the communicated constituents, drawing on your background knowledge both of the situation you're in and of the conversational principles governing the interpretation of this kind of phrase. For example, the knowledge that now refers to the general time span in which the moment of utterance is included, and that it doesn't, for example, refer to the particular moment at which I utter the phrase itself. Now, of course, can have that value in other contexts. It's part of your contextual knowledge, your pragmatic knowledge, that allows you to identify the correct temporal reference for now in this particular situation. Similarly, to introduce an example that I'll turn to later, if you and I are about to play ping pong, we're standing at the ping pong table and I say, "Let's start," you will conclude that what I mean is, "Let's start playing ping pong here now." That will be the proposition that you take me to communicate. Even though that's not coded, you will obviously conclude that I don't mean, "Let's start having a picnic here now," or "Let's start reciting the program of the Front de Gauche here now." Obviously, what I mean is, "Let's start playing ping pong here now." None of that, however, is coded. It's part of the pragmatically enriched information which the hearer supplies in order to arrive at an understanding of the proposition or the content that the speaker is articulating. So contextual knowledge fills in the gaps in the message itself, and it allows the hearer to derive either a proposition from the communicated utterance, or in the case of non-assertive speech acts, it allows the hearer to derive the proposition and the appropriate propositional attitude or speech act operator. So a question, a command, a request, whatever it might be. So what I'm calling the suppletive character of pragmatics or of context follows from the strict hierarchical relationship that is built in to the way in which communication is approached in this kind of model. And in order to capture this suppletive character that context has, I want to introduce this condition called the full import condition, which is a way of just capturing how linguists traditionally conceive of the relationship between coded meaning and pragmatically supplied context. What I'm calling the full import condition has two separate clauses. The first is that for any utterance, the hearer can understand the utterance only if she actively represents the full literal semantic content, the coded content of the expression types in the utterance. So in other words, it's just a way of saying that all of the literal meaning of the utterance must be mentally represented by the hearer in the course of understanding. That's to say that you can't understand a phrase if you haven't imported or loaded or entertained or represented. It doesn't matter what word you use, the idea is clear. You have to have, in some sense, you have to have the meaning, the full literal meaning in mind, in some sense. The second clause says that for any utterance, assume that contextual information is only appealed to derivatively in order to overcome deficits or failures in the communicated literal content. So let me just illustrate that. A deficit in the literal semantic content is most obvious in the case of reference. So reference is clearly a pragmatic phenomenon, not a semantic one. What particular item in the world I'm referring to is constrained by the meaning of the word I use, but it's not determined by it. It's pragmatic factors which allow the hearer to conclude which particular referent among the many possible ones is actually being intended by the speaker during an utterance. So reference is a clear pragmatic matter which intervenes in order to allow the hearer to recover the actual import of an utterance. And Recanati has drawn attention to a number of other different processes which are similarly pragmatic, but which serve to fill in the full content of an utterance, processes that he calls things like specification or sense construction. I won't say anything in detail about them. So they're the kinds of case I have in mind when I refer to deficits of the semantic content. They're cases where the literal meaning of the words alone isn't enough for the hearer to recover the full meaning of the speaker. Cases of failure of semantic content are things like metaphor, most obviously, that Cristobal was talking about this morning, but not just metaphor, cases like irony, typical cases of implicature. All of these phenomena are ones where the literal meaning of the utterance is rejected as not corresponding to the speaker's contextual intention, and a different interpretation is sought. So on this picture, the contextual or pragmatic information is strictly suppletive of the most basic level of meaning conveyed by an utterance, that is, the meaning that's represented in the hearer's working memory. Okay, now the persistence of this kind of model in lexical semantics is strikingly inconsistent, I think, both with developments in pragmatics and with studies into cognitive processing generally, and sentence processing in particular. In all these domains, the role of literal meaning as the basic driver of the interpretive process has been increasingly questioned. And I'll shortly present some evidence against the first clause of the full import condition, the clause that says that understanding requires full representation of all the literal content. First, though, let me turn to the second clause of the full import condition, the clause that says that pragmatic enrichment only happens after literal interpretation has been completed. And let me cite some evidence against that, which, as it happens, comes principally from studies of metaphor comprehension. Many studies of metaphor comprehension in the wake of Gibbs 2002 and in fact, earlier research, but research in that tradition, which is still continuing, assumes and purports to document the idea that hearers have direct access to the metaphorical meaning of utterances. And this research goes against the idea precisely that metaphorical interpretations are only derived after the entertainment and rejection of the literal meaning. So in what follows, I intend to develop some ideas which go in the same direction as this research into metaphor, and which question the importance of semantically encoded meaning, just as it's questioned in the case of metaphor comprehension, except I'm going to highlight the role of pragmatic or contextual factors in the creation of online understanding independent of literal meaning, even in non-metaphorical, non-figurative, literal utterance contexts. Okay. Well, if pragmatics plays a purely suppletive role on the traditional picture, what's the coded content actually like? What's the minimal semantic content that's conveyed by an utterance like, we could ask? And on the picture that's traditional or conventional in much of lexical semantics, the meanings exchanged between speaker and hearer are the consolidated conceptual representations which lexical items simply label. And by consolidated, what I mean is that meanings, mental representations, include all of the factual information that's invariantly true and distinctive of the referent, regardless of whether this information happens to be relevant or not in the current discourse context. So, to put it in Langacker's terms, the conceptualization to which a meaning corresponds embodies the commonality between different reference that the term can have, while excluding the many properties that vary from one instance to the next. So the meaning of the term is just the invariant core that is common to all instances of the term. It's an absolutely classic idea which couldn't be more deeply rooted in Western conceptions of meaning. You know, Plato, Aristotle, it's deeply, deeply entrenched. This is just a particular manifestation of it. So, you know, the upshot of this for the analysis of a particular word is simply that we give an analysis of the meaning of, say, tree, which says that the meaning of tree is some sort of conceptual schema which presents a tall plant with branches, leaves, and bark. They're supposed to be absolutely inevitable, unavoidable, invariant parts of the meaning of the word tree that it has in every instance of its use. That's not quite true, though, is it? Because, you know, the tree to which a speaker might currently be referring could well not have any leaves at all. It might, under certain circumstances, also not have any branches or bark. That would be the case when it's just been chopped down and is waiting to be turned into timber in a sawmill. Nevertheless, though, on this particular conception of the way that communication works, the hearer, even in a context like that, represents the full invariant semantic concept content, even though none of it is necessarily true or relevant in the current discourse context. Okay, now, challenges to this kind of picture have come from research in psychology, in cognitive science, in artificial intelligence, and in some varieties of linguistics itself, including phonology. All of these sorts of critiques have been forthcoming in the last couple of decades. It seems, I think, no doubt to cognitive scientists, rather old hat these days. I think it's still quite new to most linguists, so it's worth dwelling on, I think. And the net result of these critiques has been a recognition of the explanatory gains that result from a diminished role for consolidated conceptual knowledge in the analysis of cognitive processes. As is often the case, however, and as I've just suggested, general linguistics has been rather slow to take account of these kinds of developments, apart from some intimations of related ideas in some parts of in some parts of pragmatics, in some parts of cognitive linguistics, and to a certain extent in relevance theory. I'd say that these ideas are only just beginning to have any real effect on the discipline of linguistics and semantics generally. The critique that this newish paradigm would make is that traditional accounts of cognition focus too much on the passive storage of information and too little on the importance of situated action, to quote Lawrence Barcelou's particular formulation of this critique. And this is the spirit in which I'm trying to intervene today on the relation between meaning and context. I'd like to de-emphasize the role of semantics and go in a pragmatic direction even more firmly than is usually done. Okay, now, and there are some references which I won't leave on the screen long enough for anyone to write them down, so my apologies for that. Many researchers into non-linguistic cognitive processes argue that the cognitive system harnesses features of the world itself as an alternative to the explicit manipulation of mental representations. And there are many, many classic illustrations of this in non-linguistic cognition, but what I'd like to do here is to try and consider how this kind of reasoning might apply to language even though language is traditionally considered to be the domain that's least appropriate to this kind of situated approach. So let's embark then on a little illustration, a little fable, which I think is representative. So imagine two people standing at the ping pong table I mentioned earlier. And imagine that they're either outside, like on the slide, or in an otherwise empty room, say a garage. In other words, a place where there's really nothing else in the environment. And let's imagine that there's a single bat on the table. And one of the players, the one who doesn't have the bat, says to the other, "Pass the bat." So that's the simple situation that I'm asking us to consider. How do standard models of sentence comprehension understand what happens in a situation like that? Well, the standard assumption is that on hearing the sentence "pass the bat," the hearer processes that sentence exhaustively, with the full consolidated semantic representations of all the words being activated. And it's in virtue of entertaining all of those full consolidated semantic representations that the hearer is able to understand what the speaker is asking them. The hearer accesses the semantic representation of bat and notices that there is something in their current environment which matches the properties of that semantic representation. The word bat has the specifications flat-surfaced, handheld instrument for striking balls. The hearer notices that in front of them in their environment, there is precisely a flat-surfaced, handheld instrument for striking balls. And on the basis of that recognition, hands the object to the speaker, which matches the semantic specification that they have just decoded. Okay, that's the classic picture of the way that comprehension is able to happen through the mediation of language. But what's interesting, I think, it's not for me to say what's interesting and not, that's for you to say, but what I'm going to draw our attention to is the fact that in the current situation, none of that extensive decoding is necessary for the hearer. The hearer has no reason, no need to realise that the object in front of her is a flat-surfaced, handheld instrument for hitting balls. All the hearer needs to realise is that the object in front of her is the only one that is possible to pass. It's the only object capable of being passed. So assuming that the speaker is acting in conformity with standard pragmatic cooperative principles, there's simply no need for the hearer to instantiate or entertain any of the information that appears in a conceptual definition of the sort that we identify with literal meaning. The hearer doesn't need to refer to any of this information since they don't need to distinguish the bat from anything else. There's nothing else in the room which could be passed. The hearer, therefore, isn't called on to undertake any discrimination about which possible referent the speaker might have in mind. In other words, the context completely preempts the semantics, by which I mean the context makes semantic representation entirely redundant. It supplies all of the information that the hearer needs in order to successfully conclude the linguistic transaction that they're part of. So the structure of the world itself, the structure of the environment itself, means that a consolidated representation of the meaning of the word bat needn't play any role in the hearer's response. The hearer can understand without using any part at all of the conceptual representation that's associated with the word bat. That's not to say that they lack a conceptual representation of bat. Obviously, they know what bats are. They have concepts about bats. It's just that in order to successfully conclude a linguistic transaction, in this case, none of that information is needed. So the point of this illustration is to suggest that the context, goals, and also, as we'll see, the time pressure of the situation, the discourse context, all direct which aspects of an agent's knowledge are brought to the processing of the utterance at hand. And what's interesting is that as the environment becomes more complex, the context will preempt less of the information that's necessary for successful linguistic interaction. The hearer will have to draw on more of their knowledge of bats if the context becomes more complicated. So imagine that there is both a bat and a ball on the table. If the speaker says, "Pass the bat," the hearer has to realise which of the two possible reference the speaker intends to refer to. And in order to do that, they will have to, or they may have to, appeal to the coded semantic representation of the word bat to see whether or not it matches the one of the possible reference that can be passed. So what I'm suggesting is that the number of possible reference is one of the factors that influences the extent to which the hearer is obliged to mentally represent the full consolidated meaning of a communicated expression. It's not the only factor, though. As you can see on the screen, there's at least one other obvious factor which enters into consideration here. That is the likely conversational habits of the speaker. If you say to me, "Pass the bat," and I happen to know that you often make unreasonable requests, if I know that you are likely to say something that's either unreasonable or joking or ironic, if I'm habituated to the idea that you don't always mean what you say, I will obviously have to attend more closely to your actual words. Conversely, if I know that you always ask for the bat, then I won't need to listen to what you say at all. Okay. So knowledge of the interactional context and the particular proclivities of the speaker is another factor which can enter into the or determine the extent to which a representation of the full consolidated knowledge content of an expression is needed. So I don't think that this is in any way an artificial kind of situation. I think that linguistic exchanges are typically situationally embedded, goal-oriented, and speaker-specific in just the ways I've suggested they are in the example that I've given. So in natural discourse in other contexts, the role that is played by the empty room in my thought experiment can be played by any number of other factors, all of which have the same effect as the empty room. Namely, they narrow down, sometimes vastly, the range of possible reactions that the hearer can make to a speaker's request. And they therefore preempt the extent to which a complete consolidated semantic representation needs to be entertained in order to guarantee comprehension. So in these kinds of situations, the hearer understands the words that are spoken to them perfectly well, even though they've activated only a small amount of the consolidated knowledge that constitutes the expression's definition, or perhaps none of that knowledge. So these kinds of contexts are one where understanding happens without any meaning being represented, because the world does it for you. That's the idea I'm trying to highlight, the idea that the world or the environment does it for you. Language doesn't need to do anything. Okay, and I compare this kind of phenomenon to the well-known phenomenon of under-specification, but before I get onto that, let me just say that what I'm calling these kinds of semantic representations are subminimal. So, in other words, the hearer doesn't even represent what's thought of as the minimum amount of knowledge that is thought to constitute the definition of the word. Meaning is typically thought of as, you know, the invariant core of the knowledge that is associated with particular reference. In the case of trees, it's just the knowledge that you've got that it's a plant with branches, leaves, and bark. It's thought that that's, you know, that's the minimum amount of knowledge that inheres in the concept tree. The cases I'm suggesting are representative are ones where even that minimal level of invariant knowledge doesn't need to be represented. So the conceptualizations are sub-minimal. And they have the same sort of example of processing and other advantages that have been suggested to attach to under-specified representations in language use more generally. But I don't have time to talk about them in any more, in any detail at all. I think it's clear, though, that if the kind of case that I've been talking about is representative, then it has some interesting consequences for our conception of the way that context and meaning is related, precisely because it's a case where context does even work which was thought previously to necessarily be done by language. I also allude here to some research in semantic processing, the famous Moses allusion, which gives some sort of experimental backing, it seems to me, to this kind of phenomenon. I'll have to skip over that. I just want to stress, though, Sanford's conclusion on the basis of these kinds of studies, which is that not all lexical semantic information is necessarily used. Instead, local semantic processing seems to have been overshadowed by pragmatics and perhaps even replaced by it in many instances. That's precisely the conclusion I'm arguing for on other grounds today. Okay, so I think I have about 10 minutes left or so. What I want to say first is that I think there are, you know, some clear respects in which the kind of phenomenon that I've just identified problematizes the traditional project of lexical semantics, where we understand by lexical semantics the project of specifying the knowledge structures which are necessarily activated by the utterance of expressions. The kinds of result that I've been suggesting suggest that there may not be any such knowledge structures. Okay, let me then pass to the second respect in which I want to consider the relationship between context and meaning. I think context is usually something that we see as surrounding the utterance. We see it as something external to the speaker. It's something that shapes the linguistic properties of the speaker's utterance in some way independent of the speaker's cognitive processes. And linguists, at least, assume that, you know, we can achieve an exhaustive understanding of linguistic communication simply by attending to the semantics, as studied by semanticists, and on the other to the pragmatics, as studied by pragmaticists. Now, that's surely a severe idealization. Obviously, speaker and hearer don't just switch off the rest of their brains when engaging in linguistic communication. Still less are they lobotomized of all but their semantic or pragmatic competencies when they communicate. Talking is a whole brain activity. It's a whole person activity. So what I'd like to do, perhaps this is stretching the notion of context a bit too far, but still perhaps I'd like to talk about what we might perhaps consider as an internal or a cognitive context. In other words, the question of what else is going on inside the speaker at the same time as they are engaging in semantic and pragmatic processing. What's notable, I think, about the received picture of semantics is that it postulates a single type of semantic representation that is assumed to be constant across all discourse processes, or rather across all discourse contexts. So semanticists assume that It's the same fully consolidated, rich conceptual representations which get activated, more or less regardless of the kind of discourse situation that the speaker is in. But the reason that this seems anomalous is that it's a well-known fact that in every other dimension of linguistic structure, ordinary discourse isn't homogeneous. There are great variations when we move from one kind of discourse to another. And one of the particular important variables here is the question of the speaker's degree of attention to their own linguistic acts. Okay, and this is what I want to concentrate on now. Now, the amount of attention a speaker pays to their speech, in other words, their self-consciousness while they're speaking, this has been recognised as an influence on linguistic output at least since Lebov 1972. So it's a well-established feature of the variationist approach to language. Psycholinguists more recently, however, seem to have started to hypothesise that semantics as well is also affected by this variable of attention. So according again to Sanford, whom I've already quoted, those things that are attended to receive deeper, more extensive semantic processing. That's his claim about what studies of semantic processing tell us. And he says that that's not unexpected because, as I've suggested myself, that's a standard result elsewhere in the psychology of attention. And I want to try and think through in the few minutes I have left, I want to try and think through what the consequences of this might be for the kinds of traditional semantic analysis that get undertaken in linguistics. And I want to do this, I want to distinguish two particular contexts or modalities of language use, planned and free language use. Planned language use occurs in contexts where the speaker is consciously paying attention to the communicative effectiveness of their words, and where, as a result, they're more consciously aware of the normative constraints to which their language is subject. Conversely, in free or unplanned language use, or less planned language use, participants aren't paying any particular attention to those kinds of factors. They're speaking spontaneously and without special care. Well, what's the interest of that distinction, you might ask? And perhaps the answer is this. The answer is that one can hypothesise that consolidated, information-rich, decompositional analyses of meaning, in other words, exactly the ones which are traditional in semantics, those kinds of semantic representation, it seems plausible to argue, are most psychologically real for planned language use. In planned contexts, speakers are consciously aware of the factual and communicative constraints to which their words are subject, and they deliberately strive to satisfy those constraints. So insofar as definitional structures capture those constraints, then the decompositional analyses we advance of words' meaning may have some psychological reality. They may actually reflect the conceptualizations which speakers entertain while they're planning and regulating their utterances. So it's in planned contexts, I'm suggesting, that the full import condition is also most likely to hold. In free contexts, by contrast, speakers are unlikely to be deliberately subjecting their language use to these constraints. As a result, the psychological reality of consolidated decompositional analyses of meaning is diminished, and the full import condition is less likely to hold. And we can see these two contexts of language use, free and planned, as the endpoints of a continuum. So planned contexts are ones which have some combination of the properties that I've got on the screen. High degree of conscious control, attention to explicit normative standards, effort made to match the words used as precisely as possible to the reference intended, and particularly likely where the speaker is not sure that their words are going to be understood. If I don't think that you're likely to understand me, I'm going to be particularly careful in the choices of words that I use, and I'm going to be particularly anxious to ensure that there's the correct matching relationship between language and world. Free contexts have all the other properties. They're spontaneous, they're not consciously planned, they're not the object of a high degree of attention. They occur in contexts where the speaker isn't worried about the possibility of communicational breakdown, and as a result can relax the normative controls that they would otherwise subject their language use to. Okay. So in planned contexts, I've said the full import condition is likely to be true, precisely because the speaker is directing their attention to the full import of their words, and they're trying to ensure that the language world matching relationship is in fact in place. But of course, there's another aspect in which the full import condition can be observed, in that if I am in fact confronted with a situation of communicative breakdown, if, that is, you clearly don't understand what I mean, and if that lack of understanding is centred on a particular word, I can actually verbalise an explicit definition of the word that I had in mind. And that's sort of the limiting case, I think, of the relevance of the full import condition. In a case of an explicitly articulated verbal definition, such as when I say, oh, tree, you know what a tree is. It's a tall plant with leaves, branches, and bark. There, I perform the full import condition. I actually articulate a consolidated verbal definition and use it as an instrument of semantic repair. So I've suggested that fully consolidated definitions, which observe the full import condition, are observed in two kinds of linguistic situation only. First, they're observed in cases of planned language use, and secondly, they're observed in cases of conscious verbalized linguistic semantic repair. The further we move away from those situations, I'm suggesting, the less likely it is that the full import condition holds, and the more likely it is that the traditional sorts of semantic analysis given by your traditional lexical semanticist, the less likely it is that they have actually any psychological interest. And I summarise that on this slide. So as the context becomes freer, the more minimal, holistic, and pre-programmed the semantic representations underlying speech can be, and the more important become things like entrenchment, gestalt effects, and so on in the psychological processes that subtend speech. Similarly, I'd like to suggest that what we can broadly call expressive content comes to the fore, the less planned language use becomes. So the more free the linguistic context, the more likely what Potts calls the affective dimension is to play a role. So in other words, I can speak from feeling and not from thought, to put it in the most sort of caricatural terms. The less attention I pay to the rigid normative constraints that govern the language-world relation, the more likely I am to speak emotionally, to use words in a way which bring out their expressive dimension, not their rational one. Okay, so if this kind of internal or cognitive context really exists, then this removes the surprising immunity that semantics previously had to the influence of contextual variables on linguistic structure. Contextual variables were previously thought to influence everything. Semanticists generally assumed that they didn't affect semantics. I'd like to suggest that that's perhaps an assumption which it's worth revisiting. So to summarise then, what I'm wanting to suggest is that fully consolidated semantic representations that heed the full import condition often seem not to be needed or used in basic utterance events. Cases of contextual preemption demonstrate that context isn't purely suppletive. Context or the world can do the work that meaning was supposed to do, and that it's plausible that as the context becomes less planned and more free, consolidated kinds of semantic representation we're used to talking about take on a less and less important role. Donc, merci beaucoup. Et je suis prêt à prendre des questions, soit en anglais, soit en français, comme vous voulez. Merci.
I was wondering what happens in cases of ambiguity. What is the full import there? Are all the meanings of, in lexical semantics, for instance, all the meanings of a word are loaded by the hearer in this case? Or in a planned context, does the speaker has to specify all the possible exceptions of term?
That's a good question. Clearly, cases of ambiguity should be thought of as varying with the context. In other words, whether a lexical item is ambiguous or not is a function of the context, not an inherent function of the semantic representation itself. And that is similar to the kinds of ideas perhaps that we were seeing this morning. So in many kinds of contexts, an ambiguity may be completely preempted by the context. So imagine that bat is in fact ambiguous in English. In the ping pong context that I was talking about, because of this preemption phenomenon, the fact that it's ambiguous isn't even represented. The hearer doesn't need to load any of the semantic representations which could be associated with the word because the context does all that work for them. Cases of ambiguity, though, can also be a case of semantic breakdown. So, for example, if you say to me, do you have a match? Perhaps I don't know whether you mean, do I have a match of tennis this evening, or do I have a match to light a cigarette with? That could be a case which actually causes communicational breakdown. It means that I can't follow you. And in that context, we immediately then enter a planned context, because I have to attend to the particular linguistic properties of the utterance, and I have to engage in metalinguistic reasoning to work out what the normatively possible ranges of meaning of the word match are, and to hypothesise about what you were likely to have meant. So that's a planned context par excellence.
Yeah, actually, that's what happens in computational semantics. When you're doing versus disambiguation, we have to enumerate or describe all the possible exceptions of a term so that the computer, and define the conditions under which one exception is a good one in a specific context. So the computer has to choose one of them. And up to some point, we thought that was the normal thing that was done. I mean, yeah. till many years ago, but now it's considered like an artificial setting because humans do not really function that way. But something else a written language a plant context for you? Or
that's also a good question. I mean, I think it must be somewhat more planned than spoken language often is. However, even in written language, we can go closer to a free context. If, for example, I very quickly scrawl down a shopping list, you know, for someone else, that's much less planned than if I write an academic paper. So even in degrees of writing, in written language, there are degrees of planning. I don't want to think of this as a you know, absolute contrast. I want to see it as a continuum. And I think it's true that written language will be more towards the planned end of the continuum.
Would you rephrase the difference between the planned context and the free context as the difference between an expected one and a non-expected context?
I'm not sure I would. We can be in a free context, and then you say something which should be unexpected to me, but because it's a free context, it doesn't matter. You know, for example, a casual conversation in a restaurant, like we were having at lunch, you know, there's a certain sense, isn't there, where it sort of doesn't matter what you say up to a certain point. It doesn't matter whether your interlocutor has said something unexpected or not, because your reply already has a very large margin of maneuver that's available to you. So perhaps the way I should put it is to say that an unexpected conversational contribution may introduce a planned context, but it need not necessarily do so. So I think the two notions are correlated, but I don't think they necessarily match each other perfectly, though this is the first time that I've considered the question, so thank you for asking it.
I'm a bit puzzled by your point about the empty room argument, because I think that, to some extent, if it's a way to focus on a definite practice, for instance, it's about a ping-pong game, in that case, of course, it works, but it works because the context is very well-defined and very specific. But maybe sometimes it's required that the context becomes quite complex in order to be able to pick up what is relevant or not. And I think the complexity of the context is not necessarily connected with your point about, let's say, the fact that it's not necessary to represent all the aspects of the situation. So maybe there is something a bit misleading in that emphasis on the emptiness of the so-called empty room.
I certainly don't want to suggest that all contexts are simple and that all contexts preempt the semantics in the way that I've argued they do in the ping pong example. I think that would certainly be not true. What I'm suggesting is just that there are some contexts. So I've got an existential quantification, not a universal one, for that example. Some contexts I think are like that. And I think probably there are quite a lot for the reasons that I gave. You know, particularly cases which are often thought of as ones of entrenchment or conventionalization, but also other cases, ones where, you know, there's just not that many ways that one can react. So, for example, you're sitting in a car, okay, you're in the passenger seat, the driver tells you to do up your seatbelt. Okay, once you've heard the words do up, okay, you know what's coming. Okay, so you don't need to represent the meaning of seatbelt. Perhaps if you know that the driver always tells you that, perhaps, for example, if you know that the driver is particularly, you know, concerned about your vitality or fascist or whatever, however you want to describe it, you know that they're going to say that before they've said anything. So you don't even need to, you can understand without representing at all. So my point is just that such situations do exist, and that they're usually not considered as important.
Thank you. I really enjoyed this talk very much. I wanted to ask you about the relationship between the planned and free context, planning and improvisation in a way, and the shared knowledge of the speaker and listener, and whether we can jointly attend to something easily or not. Because I am thinking about especially very ritualistic contexts in which we know perfectly well how it works and everything is neatly planned, but at the same time we are not planning we are not worried about the other person not understanding very particular things because of genre knowledge or knowledge of the ritual.
Right. So that sounds like a free context to me.
Sounds like a free context, but since it has culturally a very high degree of planning that tells you what you have to say at every moment, and you cannot deviate easily from there. Maybe. Right.
But so it sounds as though it's conventionalized, it's automated, and precisely for that reason, it doesn't need to be object of conscious attention on the speaker's part. So that, I think, would fall towards the free end of the continuum. I mean, it may be that the speaker has so interiorized the cultural codes which are operative that they don't need to think. I mean, greetings are like that. Responses to greetings, I think, are perhaps a good example. If you say, ça va, I'm going to say ça va as a, you know, just automatic reply without having to think about it, almost. And that's something which is precisely supported by, you know, all sorts of cultural forces which subtend it.
So your planning just refers to the special effort to clarify things for the speaker.
It's the speaker's conscious attention to the words that they're saying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay.